This is Just In Case It Matters, the podcast that explores both the present and the past. I'm Dan Liebarger. Our guest for this edition of the show is Polish filmmaker Agnieszka Holland. She's the three-time Oscar nominee behind Europa Europa, Angry Harvest, and In Darkness. Her movies, which have been filmed in a variety of languages, have ranged from adaptations of Frances Hodgson Burnett's The Secret Garden to Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby. Recently, she's had a thriving career in television, directing episodes of The Killing and David Simon's The Wire and Tremé. While her films have dealt with subjects as weighty as the Holocaust and the death penalty, her own life has also been dramatic. Her father, Heinrich Holland, died during an interrogation by communist authorities when she was 13, and she was later exiled from her native Poland when martial law was declared in the country in the early 1980s. At the same time, she's also the mother of fellow Polish filmmaker Kasia Adamek, who frequently serves as her mom's second unit director. On June 10th, 2014, I contacted Holland about the American debut of her Czech-language miniseries Burning Bush, which has been playing theatrically in New York and is also available to watch on Fandor.com. The series follows the aftermath of the suicide of pro-democracy activist Jan Pollock, who burned himself to death to protest the Soviet occupation in 1969. Pollock's act of defiance led attorney Dagmar Burasova, played by Tatiana Pahufova, to take on the seemingly futile case of trying a KGB official for defaming the late activist. The series combines fact and fiction in a vivid depiction of what Czechoslovakia was like at the end of the Prague Spring. Believe it or not, Holland was actually a film student at the FAMU Film School during the time that Burning Bush actually takes place. So movies like hers and The Unbearable Lightness of Being have a resonance for her and others that they might not have otherwise. She spoke with us through Skype about the past and the future of Prague from her native Warsaw. The recording now, and my first question for you was, what was it like for you to return to the Czech Republic to work on something?
Well, you know, I was slightly like afraid of that you know it's like really back to the future, but very quickly it became totally natural. You know, I was very happy in the first place that I had the occasion to tell this story and to, you know, and to be in Prague for longer than a few days after such a long time. And actually, you know, finally it was probably the best experience I had for ages, you know, in terms of the work and everything.
And why do you think you liked it so much?
Yeah, because it was, you know, it was deep. It was deep experience, and the people, and I've been on the same, you know, tune as with my collaborators, you know, the producers and with the writer.
Yes. Now, one of the things that I would like to know, if it's not too intrusive, is what was the nature of the activism you were involved with when you were 20, the same age as Mr. Pollock?
Which Mr. Pollock?
Jan Pala, or is it Pawlacz?
Oh, yeah, sorry. What do you mean?
You had been involved. You had been doing some protesting. Is that correct? During
yes,
that time,
I've been involved in the student protest, in the student movement, and I've been arrested in some point, and you know, jailed for 1 month, and then was actually sentenced to some, you know, price in prison. Pain in prison, which I never did after this, you know, first prison. And I was, you know, I was very much part of that. So, and I was exactly Palak's age, and went through the same, you know, hope during the Prague Spring, and after, you know, the shock during the Russian invasion, and after, you know, the kind of the disillusion that the people are accepting the situation so quickly. So I understood perfectly well what was his state of mind and, you know, heart.
Yes. And one of the things that I was also struck by is, even though you took part in the movement, the way you portray the movement in the film is three-dimensional. I noticed that many of the men in the movement want women to make them coffee, as if they're not strong enough men to handle that themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I just noticed again and again in your depiction of 69 Prague that, you know, today it's like a woman would tell a man, get your own damn coffee.
Well, you know, I'm not sure if they will. In Poland, certainly not. Maybe more in Prague, but still the women are, you know, it was the ages of, you know, submission, you know, it doesn't pass so quickly. And at the same time, you know, the men became so less powerful that the women has at least keep the exterior sign of the, you know, submission. To let them feel better. So this gender thing, it's still very complicated in post communist countries.
Interesting. Well, another thing though that again grabbed me the most from watching this was how you portray both, you know, you portray both the communists and the people who objected to them with, in a very three-dimensional way, because a lot of times I ended up liking the policeman who was investigating Mr. Pollock's suicide.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that was like that, you know. It was more gray than black and white, and of course you had some real, you know, real scums, and, you know, and the guy who was the KGB guy.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly not the nice person. The guy who, you know, who was making this provocation with the mother and stuff like that. Certainly he wasn't, you know, a nice guy. But mostly I'm not interested in, you know, in to be the district attorney, you know, not to I don't want to judge the people, you know. I want to try to understand their destinies and their choices, and most of the choices in the regime like that are impossible. You know, you cannot, except if you are the hero, and very few people are the hero. You are just too weak to, you know, to resist, and most of the people accept, you know, the compromises and conformism. It's just like that. It's their life, you know, and they have only one life. So they will be not, you know, and what Pala did, what his sacrifice, was so extreme that actually, I think it accelerated to some extent the process of the resignation, because the people told to themselves, if to fight for freedom means something so extreme, we rather will accept, you know, that we don't have the freedom.
Yeah.
So I don't expect that the people will be heroic. I'm always amazed but somebody who actually is heroic.
Yeah, well, one, I would have to say I really was tickled to death to learn about Dagmar.
Mm-hmm.
Is she still living?
Yeah, but she's very sick, you know. So I was unable to meet her. The writer met her, but after she was too sick, so we talked to her husband, who is, you know, in very good shape, and her daughters.
Yes, well, one of the things that struck me was I was impressed that she would take on a case where, in a totalitarian regime, you would basically stand no chance of winning, no matter how close you were to the truth.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was like, you know, it's what Havel did, which a lot of Polish and Soviet dissidents did. No one like hoped that the communists will fall and apart. We've been thinking that doing some kind of protestation actions, an illegal action, that we just are doing it to express some kind of moral standing, not because we've been believing that we can win it politically. So it was actually quite pure. And most of those people, when the freedom came, didn't know what to do with that, because they didn't know how to use the political dimension, the normal, political game. They've been fighting for the moral issues more than for real issues.
Wow. Because I remember when you and I talked back in the 90s, you said that in Poland there had been a big problem with materialism once communism had fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Is the former communist bloc still trying to wrestle with that issue?
I think that former communist bloc doesn't know what to do with the world of values. So it's not like the policy, it's not something like the ideas for the countries, which has some consistency. It's everybody is trying to do what he thinks is right or not right, what is good for him. It's very selfish society, actually. But not only, post-communist countries, also the capitalist countries. But in post-communist countries, it's pretty bitter, because we expected that, freedom means something beautiful, and actually it's not so beautiful. It's certainly economically much better than it was before, but the people are not like more generous to each other.
Well, one of the things I also thought was really interesting is this screenwriter, he's a graduate of FAMU, is that correct?
Yes.
And so they thought you were the perfect person to try to make this story realized.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a correct assessment, that you were the person they thought, hey, this is who should make our movie?
Yeah, I was their first and only idea.
Wow. Now, do you think, being Polish, you might have had a somewhat different perspective than...
I think that it's not the accident that no Czech director was able to tell this story so far. No movie about this period, which was really serious and, had the wider perspective, was made in Czech Republic or Slovakia. So probably it was some kind of the block, the writer, the director's block on the subject. And the fact that I was like, for them, some kind of the probably ideal person, because I'm from outside, I'm Polish, but with some, with some romantic, gene, even if I try to fight it. And I don't like to turn tragedy to some kind of joke. I think that some tragedies needs to be told in the serious way. And also, I'm living, you know, in the war, so I'm not dependent on actual, you know, political game in Poland or in Czech Republic or whatever. And I also have more universal perspective. But in the first place, it was my experience as well, and very deeply so, because, you know, when it happened, all of that, I was very young. It was my first such an important experience. It made me who I am, you know. So, and I was only person, only filmmaker, which had Czech experience among my generation, who never made the real compromises, you know, who never was in some way collaborating with the regime, except of those who never did anything, you know, but
yeah.
then they don't have, you know, enough of experience to tell the story. So it was some kind of the coincidences which made me the right person for doing that. And also, I think, gave some special quality to my work, which was attractive to Czech audience also, because they suddenly have seen their own life and their own experiences with totally new eyes.
Now, why did you choose? Krakow had a really good film school at the time you were coming of age. Why did you choose FAMU over Krakow? Or Lodz.
It wasn't Krakow, it was Lodz.
Oh, Lodz, sorry. Thousand pardons.
Yeah. Well, you know, for many reasons, which are, you know, first reason was that I had bad name, you know. I was half Jewish. My father was arrested and died during the, you know, investigation. And his name was very, you know, unpopular among the party people. And this school was politically very, you know, highly watched. And also, so I didn't have the chances to be admitted there, you know. The going to Prague was some kind of the bypass.
Okay.
That was the main reason. And the political situation in Poland became very unpleasant in this time, and political situation in Czechoslovakia started to be really interesting. And also Polish cinema was in deep crisis in this moment, and the Czech cinema, the new wave, you know, with Miloš Forman and Ivan Passer and Jan Niemec, and so was growing, you know. It was the most original cinema in this time. So it was, you know, and Lodz is pretty sad city, and Prague is beautiful, so I had no reason, you know, to try to go there. And then I did the tests, and I was the best among other, you know, students who tried to go there, and so they took me immediately.
Oh, wow. Yeah, now, one of the things to me was kind of interesting is you've often described HBO America as the best studio you've ever worked for. What was it like working with their European counterpart?
It was as good.
Oh, wow.
They are less experienced, you know, because they are not producing so much. So they've been a bit scared, you know, because it was a big production for them and the first one of this kind. But they've been very supportive, and, you know, and these young producers who developed this story together with the writer, you know, who've been still the students in the, you know, in the film school when we've been doing it. They didn't graduate yet. They've been fantastic. So it was great crew, you know. So, as I told you, it was probably one of the happiest experiences I had in during class many, many years.
Yeah, now, one thing I remember you told me, and I wanted to confirm this, you know how your memory ruins things? Is it true that you had translated The Unbearable Lightness of Being from Czech into Polish?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if I were to get a Polish edition of that book, you would be the author of the translation.
Yeah, so far it is the case. I don't know if they will not do another one, but by now it's still my translation, which is in the shops.
Oh, wow. And how long have you known Mr. Kundera?
from the first year of my schooling, because he was teaching the history of the literature, you know, for all students of the first grade.
Oh, wow.
So I came then, and it was, he was fantastic, actually, teacher, you know. It was very exciting, his lessons, because it was very personal, very original approach. It wasn't like regular, you know, boring kind of the history of the literature. It was very Kundera's history of the literature.
Yeah. You and I are both, you know, we appreciate the hard work that Philip Kaufman put into the film, but as I was reading the book, I noticed that so much of it, even though I'm reading it in translation, was in the language, and to me that didn't seem like something you could film.
Mm-hmm.
With the unbearable lightness of being.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's a pretty fair assessment?
I think that Philip did a great job, you know. I think, of course, you know, if the fact that it's in English and so was like, you know, made it a bit fairy tale-ish.
Yeah.
But on another hand, it, you know, it was accessible to the people over the world easily. And I loved, you know, I loved Juliette Binoche in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I thought she was extremely touching.
And I had a terrible crush on Lena Olin after I saw it.
Uh-huh. Well, I preferred Juliette, you know, but you know better. But Miss Lena was great also. Actually,
yeah.
I think that it was not the best role for Daniel Day-Lewis. I think that he didn't got Thomas.
Yeah.
It was a difficult character to play, certainly. Anyway, it was. I think it was a good film. And then I met Philip in Telluride last year, and he watched Burning Bush, and he really loved it, so he was very generous about it.
Oh, he's one of my... he was one of my favorite people to interview him. I interviewed him about Quills.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because I'm so obsessive, and I actually could understand how each film related to previous ones he made, apparently most interviewers don't do that. But I had a ball talking to him. Anyway, one of the things that's also really fascinating about Burning Bush is the way you make it look. Because I noticed you're somewhere between color and black and white.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide on the visual strategy?
We've been discussing it a long time, you know, with Martin Sterbau, a cinematographer, who is very talented and very wise guy. And we did an experiment with the colors. First we thought about black and white all together. HBO wasn't crazy about it, but after, you know, trying it, I wasn't crazy about it also, because it made it dated in some way, you know. But like totally normal, full color wasn't right neither, so we've been playing the color depending on the scenes, you know. The scenes in the police stations and so was more monochromatic, the scenes in the Dagmar's house was more colorful and warmer, and when we've been going to the funeral, which was mixed of the our footage and the archive footage, we slowly went into black and white, and after came back, you know. So it was like piece by piece. It wasn't that we decided this will be like that and this will be like that. We've been trying like that it breathes, you know. The color in some way gives some, the amount of color, intensity, density of color, and color of the color gives some supplementary, you know, dramaturgical meaning.
Oh, yeah. I certainly noticed that. And also, why do you think that the generation, say, that yours were... In the Czech Republic, were so hesitant to talk about 1969?
It wasn't so much, I think, a bit about 1969. It was more about the normalization. It means, you know, I think that the most painful memory is the memory of the humiliation and their powerlessness and the fact that they didn't really resist. So it is like, you know, the generation of my generation, the people, and even younger, they don't want to look bad because they don't like themselves in this. So they try to mythologize it. Oh, they are silencing it, like, the, you know, Jews after Holocaust, where during 30, 40 years, practically, they didn't speak about it, the survivors. It's a bit similar mechanism. Of course, it wasn't such a terrible trauma like Holocaust, but it was in some way, it was stolen life, you know. The lives of two generations have been stolen. In the same time, they had the normal, like, life, family life, and, you know, some ambitions and blah, blah, blah. But in the same time, it wasn't like full life. It wasn't like they've been not free, and they knew it, or they didn't want to know it, but they in some way felt it. So I think that if they've been coming back, it was like in jokey way, you know, like, oh, it wasn't so bad. Oh, actually, it was funny. Oh, it was absurd. Oh, it was, you know, we've been young, you know. So it was some kind of lie, silence or lie. And in most of post-communist countries, you have this kind of mechanism, you know. The normalization, this 20 years which came after Prague Spring, was particularly painful, and also the regime was very hard on the people. Not only they you know, jailed the dissidents all the time, but also they forced regular folk to sign the letters, you know, you know, to collaborate, really. They didn't let people be. Everybody had to, like, do something he's ashamed of.
Oh. That's awful. But I know you're probably extremely tired, so I'm going to give you a final question.
Okay.
One of the things that I thought was striking with Burning Bush is that it ends, to me, kind of like, say, the movie All the President's Men ends. You know, we end with, oh, well, this didn't work, but then in some ways the audience knows something the characters don't know, which is 20 years later this force will fall. To me, that was actually a very clever approach, because, you know, and I guess, to me, if anything, it says that maybe other movements like the Czech experience, maybe the worst thing you can do is give up.
Well, you know, I think that it's history which made it, you know, this happy ending. Because it really, you know, the wave of the protestation which led to the Velvet Revolution started with the 20th anniversary of Palach's death. And everybody could think during these 20 years that he was totally forgotten, you know, and suddenly totally young people who've been even not alive when he died. They, you know, came to the streets, and they traveled to his to the cemetery in his village where he was born. You know, it means it started with that. So it is, in some way, the, you know, expression of burning bush. It means it's from the Bible. It's, you know, where the God shown himself to Moses, and this bush burns forever. You know.
So that's right.
So it is. Suddenly it was, you know, like, it meant something, it led to something. It wasn't totally, you know, sadly and absurdly unnecessary, you know. But, of course, I know very well that we have in the history plenty of acts like that which don't lead to some kind of happy endings. And, of course, after, you know, the audience has to ask themselves the bitter question, what we did with our freedom, you know, 25 years after, if we are happy with our freedom, you know, if we are able to create our freedom. But that is, you know, another movie.
Thanks, Agnieszka. Well, that's it for another edition of Just in Case It Matters. The theme music you're hearing right now is by my nephew, Jackson Leibarger. This podcast is copyright 2014, just in case it matters. Have a good day.